I'm Jeremy Wolf. I'm the incoming East District Chair of the URJ, and it's my pleasure today to be introducing Marty Linsky. Let me tell you that Marty Linsky is co-founder of Cambridge Leadership Associates. He's been faculty at the Harvard Kennedy School for over 30 years, author of a dozen books and chapters, including Leveling the Playing Field, Advancing Women in Jewish Organizational Life. He was a Massachusetts state legislator, a reporter and an editorial writer at the Boston Globe, and chief secretary to the Massachusetts governor. You didn't say which governor. Bill Weld, if you're keeping track. He claims to have been overeducated at William College and Harvard Law School. When he sent me this note, it said, three married children, one grandchild, another coming. I learned coming in today that the second grandchild has arrived today. Yesterday. And he lives in New York now with Lynn Staley, former assistant managing editor at Newsweek, and an accomplished painter in her retirement. He exercises daily in order to make us feel guilty. He is into decluttering in order to make us feel more guilty, relaxing at his house in Italy, rooting for the Red Sox, enjoying good drink, vegetarian food, and he's apparently got 25,000 baseball cards.
Let me try to share with you my perspective on this, and let's see if we can have as much of a conversation as possible. Here's where I start. I start with this proposition. I am probably, as I look around, probably the oldest person in this room. And I've never, in my lifetime, this is the most interesting time I've ever lived in. I mean, the 60s were close, although I missed most of the fun part. My wife is 7 years younger than I am, and we lived in, we both spent most of our early years in Boston. She grew up in Washington State, but during those 7 years were the critical 7 years. You know, I graduated from college in 1961. She graduated college in 1970. The whole world had changed, right? So I was in the legislature between 67 and 72, and we often talk about the fact that while I was in the state legislature making laws regulating drug use, she was in Central Square trying them all out. So I don't know where I got us into that. But anyway, this is the most interesting time I've ever lived in, because to me, I've never lived in a period where there was such rapid, constant change, and there was so much uncertainty about how it's going to turn out, what's going to happen next. And we all think we live in unusual times and unique times, but it feels to me this is different. Now, the challenges facing the Reform Jewish movement are better known to you than they are to me. I read the same, you know, in a superficial way, I read some of the same stuff you read, the Pew Report and the challenges from other dominations, the challenges from unaffiliated, challenges from intermarriage. We all know those dynamics that are out there in the world. The point I would make about those, which may be true or not true, may be comforting or not comforting, but from my perspective is relevant, is that the kind of challenges, deep systemic challenges, that the Reform movement is facing are similar in many ways to what's going on with institutions all over the world, secular and religious. I spent Monday and Tuesday with the United Methodist Council of Bishops. And trust me on this, the conversations were all not all that different than some of the conversations I've heard today. Because what's happening, and we're all affected by what's happening in the world, and the pressures that are the disruptive pressures that are affecting the Reform Jewish movement particularly are ripple effects from similar pressures all over the place. You know, if you think about just in the last 10 or 12 years, what is going on in the world, again, you know this as well as I do, but the cultural challenges that the millenniums pose, the Arab Spring and the aftermath of that, the climate change, technology. You know, I grew up in the 50s when the, you know, U.S. hegemony in the world was taken for granted. War was one country against another country. I mean, the world is completely different now. And so the question that that brings me to, which is where we are assuming that this is a new normal, that we are going to be living in a period of rapid, constant change and future uncertainty. What does that mean for how you or I or anybody else exercise leadership? And when I talk about exercising leadership, from my perspective, it has nothing to do with your position, your job, your role in the Jewish community, or in the rest of your life, for that matter. To me, leadership is a behavior. It's not a person. It's something some people do some of the time. And my assumption is if every one of us in this room, me included, exercise leadership more often than we do, the world would be better off. And so the question to me is, what kind of leadership, what is it about the way we understand leadership that has to be changed under the circumstances in which we are now living? Assuming, which is my assumption, that the conditions of rapid change and future uncertainty are going to be with us for a while, certainly for the rest of my life and maybe for the rest of yours as well. So if that's true, if we're living in a different kind of time, if it's characterized by these particular qualities, great uncertainty, rapid change, then what does that mean in terms of how you think about your own leadership? My assumption is that you're here, I mean both here and here in Orlando, in part, at least, because you have aspirations, not necessarily for yourself, but for your community or for the Jewish community as a whole, and you're trying to figure out, in part, how you can be more effective in closing the gap between those aspirations, whatever it is you care about, whatever it is you, particular way you want to save the world or save the Jewish world, and the gap between those aspirations and the current reality. And so what I'm suggesting, my hypothesis is, that under the circumstances, under the times that we live in, whether you are a senior authority in a congregation, or you're a member of a board, or you're just a mom or a dad, or you're running a business, that the, or you're a teacher in a school, or you're an administrator in a healthcare system, whatever your role is, that you're the tools and the way you go about trying to lead change, trying to mobilize people to get to a better place, are going to have to be affected, tweaked in some ways by the times in which we live. So that's the proposition. What I would like to do is to suggest to you, from my perspective, six ways in which I think that the traditional way that we look at leadership has got to be tweaked. I'm not suggesting to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I'm just suggesting that there are some norms that we're accustomed to about what leadership looks like as a behavior, not as a person. Leadership is a behavior, as something people do some of the time. that there are six ways in which we have to think about how to tweak that. What I would like to do, what I had kind of planned to do, but maybe I'm not sure it's appropriate with this more intimate setting and a smaller group, what I'd planned to do is to talk about each one of them separately and then ask you to talk with a neighbor about why it would be, what would be challenging for you in your own leadership practice to do more of this newer behavior. So maybe we'll try to do that and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, we'll make a mid-course correction, which I think is part of what is needed in the times in which we live, lots of mid-course corrections. Okay? Any questions, comments, observations? I'd love to have this more of a conversation than a presentation, so I'm encouraging you to argue and question and challenge and reflect and whatever works for you. So let me go through those six one by one and begin by asking you to think about to what extent, what would it take for you to reflect, for you to embody more of this newer behavior in your own practice of leadership? That's the question I'm intrigued by. So the first is to focus less on execution than on more and more on adaptation. For particularly for those of you who are in authority roles, who have big jobs, whether it's a congregational president, whether it is a head of an organization, whether it is a mom or a dad, for those of you who think of yourselves in your authority roles, there's tremendous pressure on you to execute. I was just across the hall with some of you may have been. How many were across the hall? Okay. Across the hall were all congregational presidents and presidents-elect, and assertion that I made there is that one of the reasons they got in those roles, for the four or five of you who were here, you got on those roles, was because you'd been able to solve problems, you'd be able to get stuff done. We in organizational life, all kinds of organizations, we tend to promote people in big positions who get stuff done, who solve problems, who can take work off our shoulders and make things happen. There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody needs people who are good at that in any organization. But in times of rapid change and uncertainty, the idea of adaptation, which is different than the idea of execution, becomes more important. What is complicated about adaptation? What makes adaptation difficult is that if you use the analogy that I used across the hall, which is a species, an animal or plant species adapting, you think about the DNA of a species. Plant or animal species, when they adapt, the biologists tell me that somewhere between 6 and 10% of the DNA typically changes. Right? Well, when you lose a DNA in order to replace new DNA, that's a way for a plant and an animal species to survive. Right? You give up something that was part of your DNA, and you take on some new DNA, which is going to enable you to cope with the changing circumstances. In a human organization, in a family, in the reform movement, in a company, in a school, in any human organization, that process of adaptation, of giving up part of your DNA, is much more problematic and painful, because in any organization, there is somebody or some group who loves that part of the DNA that some other people want to leave behind, right? Whether it's a particular practice, whether it's some kind of tradition, whether it's the way we do business, whatever the pieces of that DNA are, as you try to lead change on difficult issues, right, you are talking about leaving behind something that is important to some people. In some cases, you're talking about leaving behind some people, right? And none of us are part of this movement in order to leave people behind, in order to deliver losses. And so what makes the way execution has to be ameliorated, I think, is by beginning to think of yourself as in the adaptation business more than you have in the past. And that's a different line of work. Execution is about having a plan, executing on the plan, being held accountable for it, doing it with a high level of competence, evaluating what it's done, and getting on with the next, right? Adaptation is a very different kind of process because it's about the work, the really excruciating work of deciding of all the things we value, of all the things that has made us as wonderful as we are, of all the things that have attracted me to be part of this community, what of those things are actually holding us back now? What do we have to leave behind? That's what makes adaptive work so difficult. It's about leaving things behind. It's about choosing what is essential and what is expendable. My assumption is that every one of us in this room is perfectly capable, from a skill perspective, from a capacity perspective, of doing adaptive work, right? Of going through the process and analyzing what is essential and what's expendable, and then getting on with it, right? But what makes it difficult is that it is not only an intellectual process of choosing what is essential and what is expendable, but it is an emotional process because those things that are being left behind are, by definition, or they wouldn't still be there, important to some people, critical to some people, essential to some people. And that's what makes the work difficult. Seeing in that light, if you think about it that way, then the work of leading change on adaptive issues, value-laden issues, issues that go to the essence of who you are as an organization, that work is about the work of delivering losses, about counseling people through a grief process. I'm working with a school that has a very traditional way of doing business, and there's a guy who's in the vice president's office who is trying to move that school to a different place, and he's a wonderful fellow, and he. 5 years ago, I guess about now 6 or 7 years ago maybe, his wife, he had two little kids, two teenagers, and his wife went out shopping one day, got hit by a car and killed. And he said he spent the next year in the grief counseling business, trying to help his kids through this unbelievably unanticipated tragedy. And then what he said to me was, I feel like I'm in the grief counseling business again. He said, because I'm spending all my time not on proposing all these wonderful new ideas, but on helping people let go of stuff that was absolutely critical to them, that's important to them, that identifies them from themselves as who they are. So that's the first of the six. We need to spend more time on adaptation than we do on execution. Second, as I was suggesting before, my assumption is that everybody in this room, me included, has been rewarded for being a problem solver, for being good at having stuff thrown at you and taking care of it, fixing it. That's the way people get promoted in organizational life, by solving other people's problems for them. What a living in a period of time of rapid, constant change and uncertain futures means for the problem-solving business is that you are increasingly going to be faced with stepping into territory that no one has been before. Even though historically we can make connections between the challenges facing the reform movement in 2015 and things that have happened centuries ago, there are qualities of the challenges that we face that are distinctive and different. Nobody has been here before. What that means is that instead of solving problems, you've got to begin to think of yourself more as running experiments rather than solving problems. That's a very different orientation. The virtues of framing what you're doing as running experiments are significant. They do not satisfy the needs of people to have you solve other problems for them, you know. But they are significant. I mean, if you think about the appeal of Donald Trump right now, right? His appeal is based on his assertion that he will solve all the problems and don't worry about the details, right? And it's a very compelling appeal, right? It's always a compelling appeal historically when people are in trouble. You know, when Obama was elected in 2008 and he inherited an economy that was much, much worse than he either knew or wanted to know or had been told or something. If you go back and you look at the first 6 months of 2009, we were in a place that nobody had ever been before in the United States. No one had ever been where this economy was in 2008, the end of 2008. And the only people who understood the economy well enough to help him think about it were the people who had made the decisions that got us into the mess in the first place, right? They were the only experts around. And if you look back at those 6 months, I think what he did was run a bunch of experiments. He started a whole bunch of initiatives. The ones that seemed to be working, he pumped more money into. The ones that didn't seem to be working, he tried to kill. And the ones that needed tweaking, he tried to tweak. Now, Obama couldn't have gotten up in March or April of 2009 and said, my fellow Americans, thank you for letting me in your homes tonight. I want to tell you, we've been studying the economy. We don't have the foggiest idea what to do, but we're going to run a bunch of experiments. You know, stay tuned. We'll let you know how it's going, right? Because we don't want that from people in authority. We want people in authority who are going to solve problems, right? Get things done, fix things, right? So you're pushing against tremendous pressure from expectations when you begin to think of yourself as running experiments. But that's, in fact, what we're doing. Because when you're stepping into a place that no one's ever been before, by definition, you don't know what you're doing, right? You're running an experiment. You're making a good guess. The virtue, and I've seen this in organizations a lot, the virtue of beginning to frame what you're doing as running experiments are manifold. First of all, if you think of yourself as running an experiment, you talk to people and you say, look, we don't know, you know, I'm thinking now of the new dues structure that was passed, what, yesterday? Is that right? This morning, right? Okay. You know, no one knows for sure whether or not that's going to work or what the unintended consequence is going to be. But my assumption, I wasn't there for the conversation, but my assumption is nobody got up and said, we don't have the foggiest idea how to fix this, but we're going to run an experiment, right? You did. Well, that's wonderful. Right. when you talk about the language of experiment, you reduce the stakes so people do not feel like everything is on the line. Right. That helps enormously. Go ahead. Well, you can't talk about experiments confidently in that sense, right? Because it's an experiment. And what you're saying, when you use the language of experiment, you're saying, this is our best guess at the moment, but it's just an experiment. We don't know for sure. What I'm suggesting is that language takes some of the pressure off in itself. It also does other things. First of all, if you're running an experiment, you can run more than one at the same time. Right? There's no reason not to run multiple experiments. If you're solving a problem, you have a solution, right? If you're running experiments, you can run more than one. That's a second advantage of thinking, using the language, thinking of the frame of experiments. The third advantage is that if you're running an experiment, you have an obligation to monitor it closely. So it's not like you've solved a problem. It's like you're trying something and you have to pay lots of attention to it. The fourth is you can run you can make mid-course corrections. If things aren't seem to be working the way you intended them to be working, you can tweak it, you can change it. So the advantages of running experiments, and then the last one is the one that you said. The last advantage of running an experiment is that there is no such thing as a failed experiment. Every experiment is testing some hypothesis from which you're learning something. And the challenge in organizational life, in my experience and observation, is to think of experiments in that way and then tease out the learning and disseminate it throughout the organization. You know, from what I understand from talking to Rick and others here, you know, there's a lot of experimentation that is going on in this world right now. And the challenge will be for the organization as a whole to honor and applaud the experiments that don't work out so well the way we had hoped because something important is learned from them. And those new hypotheses can be tested again. So I think there are enormous advantages in framing what you're trying to do, which I think is also realistic, as an experiment. Yes?
I'm going to ask everybody, I know it's going to feel a little awkward, but we're actually taping this so that other people can hear it. So I'm going to ask that if you ask a question, take the mic.
Thank you. I was just wondering, do you have any experience, examples of organizations where so the leader can be speaking this way and talking about experiments, and has the culture changed of the organization that they're in, where people become more comfortable over time?
First of all, I'm allergic to the use of the word leader, so because I think it confuses this conflation, it conflates leadership with having a big job. So this is just you get rid of me in about half an hour, so you can go back to using it. But let's try to think of leadership as a behavior. So talk about exercising leadership. So if I think the question that you pose is a real one, because it's the Obama example that I was saying. You can't get up there and say, I'm the boss and I don't have the foggiest idea what we're doing, right? In that role as the senior authority, right, you may have to display more confidence than you really feel. But you can put in structures that will help you cushion the blow if it doesn't work out so well. And I think the language of experiment, particularly if it's surrounded by lots of other stuff, I'm trying to think now, you challenged me by thinking of an example. The best example I know of, there are a couple that I'm thinking about, but there was an organization that I worked with in the private sector. It was a law firm. And how many lawyers in the room except for me, in addition to me? Four of us, that's probably two or three too many. But this is a law firm. I don't know your experiences. I had very little experience as a practicing lawyer. But my observation, having worked with a lot of law firms, is that, not surprisingly, lawyers did not typically go to law school to learn how to run multi-million-dollar businesses. You know, they went to law school to practice law. And so there's a lot of tension around how we run a multi-million-dollar business, which is a business. And this law firm that I worked with, they were at loggerheads over, they had two governing units. One was elected by the partners, and one was ex officio by the role that you had in the organization, head of this department, head of that department, et cetera, et cetera. And these two bodies couldn't get along because they actually represented different values and different point of view, and they couldn't agree on anything, so all they could agree on is not to deal with the hard issues. They were in perfect agreement on that question. And one of the ways the chairman of the firm was able to get them to engage in conversations that they wouldn't have otherwise engaged in was by framing them as experiments. You know, he said, look, we've been frustrated for 2 years. Everybody agree we're frustrated? Everybody agrees we're frustrated, okay. So let's try something new. I'm not sure it's going to work, but let's try something new. And a couple of things that they did try to make a huge difference, but it was uncomfortable and it forced people to operate in different ways. So I think you're right in suggesting that it's easy for a junior person in an organization to suggest running an experiment as long as he or she has the senior authority's cover than it is for the senior authority, because the expectations on senior authorities are so strong to solve problems and know what they're doing. It's very difficult. There's a wonderful quote from Dwight Eisenhower when he talks about the D-Day invasion, and he said, we couldn't have gotten mobilized at D-Day without having a plan, because everybody needed to think that we had a plan that was going to work. He said, but if anybody ever looked at that plan, once we hit the beach, it would have been a disaster, right? So I think that's part of what you're doing. I think that's a very fair question. So the second thing is think of yourself more than you have in the past as running experiments rather than solving problems. The third has to do with autonomy and interdependence. There's a tension in all of us as human beings and in the groups that we identify with between our need for feeling autonomous and feeling a sense of agency. You know, we can control our destiny. And the reality that we're all in this together. I think that balance is shifting and that we need to let go of our desire for autonomy more than we have in the past and begin to think about living in an interdependent world in ways that we haven't before. A lot of that has to do with technology. A lot of it has to do with the complexity and of the problems, that nothing is bounded anymore. When I was a member of the legislature, before lots of people in this room were born, you actually thought you could fix something because the problems were bounded. There's no such thing. One of the reasons, in my view, that Congress is so stuck is because there are no bounded problems. So every time you push down on the system somewhere, things pop up in other places. Everything is connected to everything else. What that says to me for a movement like this movement is that you have to begin to think about yourself not only as interdependent with each other, but as interdependent with other institutions and organizations around your surround and with your environment, to be looking for unusual allies, bedfellows that no one would have expected you to be playing with before. If you think about it's often seemed to me, this may be heretical or not in this context, but it's often seemed to me that the lines of demarcation in spiritual terms, in religious terms, are much stronger based on how you practice than based on what you practice. That is, if you're a really fabulously attentive practicing Catholic, my guess is you'd be a really fabulously attentive practicing Jew. That it's about where this sits in your life as opposed to the particular content. What that suggests to me, particularly having coming back from these 2 days with the Council of Bishops, is that you have a lot more in common with other religious communities which are struggling with similar issues than you may have in common with some people who look more like you do, right? Or look more like we do. And beginning to think about what is the nature of the problems. And the problem of attracting young people to institutions is not a Reformed Jewish problem. It is a worldwide problem, and it is a US problem. And so it feels to me like there are some allies and some people similarly situated who you would never think of as part of your community that can be really useful in creating some alliances and some relationships. So that's the third point, is interdependence and the tension between independence and autonomy. The fourth point has to do with conflict. Progress on difficult issues only comes through conflict. That is the tension between deeply held perspectives banging up against each other, and the resolution of those is what makes progress. It's like an orchestra leader creating, or a symphony, creating synthesis out of dissonance. In authority positions, whether you're talking about mom and dad or you're talking about presidents of congregations, we are expected to resolve conflict, to tamp it down. I think these are times which require us to spend more time learning how to be good at nurturing conflict. The language I like to use is orchestrating conflict. Because what orchestrating conflict does, if you begin to see yourself as in the business of orchestrating conflict, surfacing conflict, what it does is allow people to see not only where the tension is, but to hear the perspective of people who feel just as strongly as they do from a very different point of view. And you can't understand how to make progress on difficult issues unless you can tell other people's stories as well as you can tell your own. And that requires, particularly in a position of authority, that requires you to spend more time protecting dissent, protecting conflict, nurturing it and serving it, rather than succumbing to the pressure which we all feel to tamp it down. We probably all had this experience when you have, your two kids are fighting and they come to, you go to them because they're screaming, or they come to you to resolve the fight. Their worst fear is that you will say to them, "Oh, that's really interesting. Now go back in your room together and figure it out," right? And that's just as true in organizational life. It is. People want people in authority to resolve conflict, and they would prefer that you resolved it against them than that you didn't resolve it at all, right? They would rather know where you stand, even if they don't like the result, so they can be angry at you, right? What this requires, I think, is a willingness to not only push back against that expectation, but also for some of us, I assume, to be able to tolerate more conflict in a community environment. Because it's only through that conflict that you can get to a synthesis on the other side when you're dealing with deep value-laden issues. So the fourth point, I guess, is thinking about yourself as in the business of orchestrating conflict, not just resolving it. Yes, please. Yeah.
Thank you. When I hear you say, I'm going to quote you, "You must be able to tell other people's stories as well as you can tell your own."
Yeah.
What I hear that as meaning as is expressing and living in a moment of empathy.
Yes.
And I don't know if empathy and conflict are the same thing, but in a sense, to me, this whole section, which I think is very interesting, to me is about being an empathetic person and understanding where other people are coming from.
I think that's right. And we were talking a lot in the other room about I don't think of empathy as a moral imperative. I think of it as a tactical necessity. That you can't understand how to move people who are challenged or threatened by what you're trying to do unless you understand how the world looks to them as cockamamie as you think it might be, right? And you can't understand it by dismissing it, because it makes sense to people. My cockamamie view of the world makes sense to me, and if you can't understand how it makes sense to me, you can't figure out how to move me. How to deal with me, right? Because if you're looking at my view of the world through your eyes rather than through my eyes, and particularly if it's very contrary to your point of view of the world, you're going to place all kinds of value judgments on that rather than trying to understand why it makes sense to me. How does it make sense to me? Because we all make meaning out of the world we're in. We all figure out a way to make sense of what we're doing. But those are just stories. They're just a ways of looking at the world. They aren't truth, you know. I mean, if you ask me, let me roll that back for a second. That's why I say the reason to understand other people's stories is more tactical and small p political than it is moral, right? Because in order to move people, you get to understand how they look at the world, no matter how silly or foolish you think it is. Right? And the way people look at the world, the way I look at the world, the way you look at the world, is a contrivance, one of my wife's favorite dismissive words. It's a creation in order to make sense of things, right? If you ask me why I'm here today, right, I would give you some extremely noble story about, you know, my own upbringing and my commitment to Rick personally, a whole bunch of stuff, right? And then if you followed up that question saying, would you be here if you weren't getting paid, right? I don't want to know how I would answer to that, right? I don't know why I'm here. I have no idea why I'm here. On my best days, if you ask me why I'm here, on my best days, you'll get a story which is the same story I'm telling myself. On my not-so-good days, you'll just get a story that I want you to hear, right? But we don't know why we do anything, right? Maybe something that happened on a playground when I was 5 years old. I have no idea why I'm here. Right? But I have to make sense out of it some way. And if you're going to try and move me, right, to come back next year for nothing, for example, right, if you're going to try and do that, right, you'd have to understand the story that I was telling myself in order to figure out how to deal with me to try to achieve that objective. So that's why I think of it more as a tactical idea than I do as a moral idea. I think it's extremely useful. And what happens in my experience and observation is that we listen to people's stories through our own filters. And we make judgments about them and their stories as we hear them, as opposed to saying, how could this cockamamie story possibly make sense? What does it come from? How does it make sense? Why does it work for that person? There's a way of understanding how to move. Does that make sense? Is it?
Another question.
Oh, sure.
Over here. So I understand the need for leaders to...
People exercising leadership,
sorry,
you meant to say.
I meant to say that.
Ten more minutes.
For people in leadership to exercise, to be comfortable with conflict.
Right.
There's a point at which that spills into the whole community is engaged in conflict, and
yes,
that becomes less productive.
Becomes what?
Less productive, perhaps.
Depends.
Often.
Yeah. Could.
Is there a way to make that productive when the entire community is subjected to that conflict?
I think the role of people in authority under those circumstances is to protect the boundaries so it doesn't spill out and so it doesn't go over the top. Let me give you a fabulous metaphor just because it's fresh in my mind because it was only 3 days ago. One of the things, United Methodists are going through some very tough times, significantly around the issues around human sexuality, but also they are in some ways a surrogate for deeper issues around where the growth in the church is coming and the resources and the allocation of resources, and there's a whole bunch of stuff going on. And every 4 years, the way the church is organized, they have their legislative body, which is like the biennial, only it's every 4 years, and people come together and they're elected delegates, some clergy, some lay, and they make legislative decisions once every 4 years. And the bishops have no formal role in that. They have no formal authority in that. And what the bishops decided to do, here's the metaphor, what the bishops decided to do is instead of what they usually do, which is sit on a podium and don't say anything, they decided they would stand all around the edges of the room, right, as a way of both literally and symbolically saying to those people, doesn't make any difference what you say, you know, sing your heart out, right? No one's going to take anything personally, and we're going to protect everybody here, right? So I think the role of a person in authority under those circumstances is really significant. It's not backing away. It's a very active, but it's a different kind of role. It's trying to, the language that we use a lot is to create a holding environment, create a safe space for you. That's why my experience is, and I assume some of you have had the same experience, it is fundamentally different to have a senior team retreat in the office than to have it out of the office. It's not just a change, it's fundamentally different, it's a completely different thing, right? Because you can get different kinds of behaviors when you're away from the workplace. So I think there's a very important role, but it's a role of managing and controlling and creating safety rather than a role of leading in the traditional sense. Does that make sense? So the fifth behavior, which I think has to be tweaked, has to do with best practices. And I say that uncomfortably because I know that one of the initiatives that I'm excited about at URJ is trying to be more disciplined about sharing best practices so that when stuff happens somewhere in this movement, that is working or is not working, that everybody else knows about it. And I think that's a good thing. On the other hand, if there is some truth in the idea that this movement is at a place right now where it's never been before, then part of what is required for each of us, for everybody individually, not just collectively, is to have the courage to invent next practices rather than focus on best practices. It is very easy to get caught up in the idea, let's find out what other people do that has worked for them and we'll copy it. That's very easy, it's comfortable, there's nothing wrong with it. It's a good practice. But it's different than saying, look, we've never been here before, we've got to invent something new. Because I think that's what's going on in the big picture with this movement. Is that it is going to be different 10 years from now than it is now. And the way it is different is going to depend, I think, to a significant degree, on people not in necessarily at the top of the pyramid, not necessarily in positions of senior authority, trying to invent the way they want it to look in the future. And those inventions, some of which will take hold. I have seen this quite dramatically in the Orthodox community. My data on this is not perfect in any ways, but I am struck by there's so much pressure in the Orthodox community around the rules and what we have to do and what we can't do, that it has stimulated, in my view, lots of inventions of next practices which no one ever imagined before, which try to play within the rules but reimagine them in different ways. Right? I don't think that kind of pressure exists. That's one of the challenges facing the reform movement. That kind of pressure doesn't exist in the system in the same way. So that's the fifth. The sixth one, which is a kind of a peculiar place to end this little litany before opening up to more conversation. The sixth one is quite personal, not personal to me, personal to each of us. And that is one of the things that, in my observation, characterizes the Jewish communal life. I do a lot of work in the Jewish community. One of the things that seems endemic, built in, is that it is noble to sacrifice your body for the cause. I think that is very misguided under the circumstances we are in. The idea that people have to work 24/7 if you have a big job in this community feels not only counterproductive to me under these circumstances, but it feels like a way of preserving the status quo. So the sixth idea is that each of us individually has to take responsibility for taking care of ourselves, rather than seeing ourselves as in the business of sacrificing our bodies for the cause. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that the one I was talking about before, which is that if you advertise to the world, to your community, that you're willing to take on more and more work, right? People will shove more and more work on you. Once you set up the signal that you're willing to take it on, then that will take responsibility off of other people's shoulders and they'll say, you'll take care of it. The second thing is that I think that the problems that the movement is facing are daunting problems in some of the dimensions that we've talked about. And what that says to me is that you, as someone who cares enough about it to be here this week, right, you need to bring your A game. And you can't bring your A game if you're exhausted, if you're eating lousy stuff, if you're snacking because you don't ever take time for a meal, if you're not getting love and attention in normal, appropriate places. Hmm. You can't bring the best of you to this work. And I think that the times we're in demand that of you. And the world is not going to support that as long as you're willing to let the world eat away at your capacity for taking care of yourself. So those are the six tweaks I'm thinking about in terms of the way we practice our own leadership has to be reimagined under the circumstances in which we live. So that's my spiel. I'm interested in feedback, thoughts, comments. We've got two here. The red shirt, Jeremy?
Red shirt.
Yes, I wanted to comment on the best practices. One of the things we noticed that all the best practices came out of Boston. What works in Boston, what works in New York, what right. works in LA is right. not going to work in West Virginia.
Right.
So we took the time and effort to create our own science. We worked with the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety, and we did our own research and created our own best practices. And over a three-year period, we took West Virginia, which had the highest rate of drunk driving in the nation, to the national average.
Yeah, that makes sense to me, you know? I mean, it's a combination of this work is customized and local, the work of leadership, and that we are in places we've never been before, so we have to invent something new to deal with it.
May I be so presumptuous as to suggest a seventh?
Sure. Let me get my pen out. Wait a minute.
Right, no.
I am a pack rocket. I've never had an original thought in my life, but I've been very good at finding other good ideas. So go ahead.
Well, this isn't a totally original thought. It comes from the Torah when God spoke with Moses, Panim El Panim, face to face. It's really important that all the things that you mentioned need to be communicated. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest changes we're all facing, and I did as 4 years of president of our synagogue, is to learn how to communicate all of these six things that you recommended. I've found that if you pick up the telephone and actually communicate with people, or actually talk face-to-face, even though you're not supposed to talk about business on Shabbat, that's where you see people. A lot of problems got solved, and a lot of experiments were developed, and all the things that you mentioned, by actually communicating face-to-face, voice-to-voice, email, and all the various ways of communicating are important, but they can inhibit all of the other six, in my opinion.
I agree with that enormously, but to me it's a broader question. I mean, that is what I hear is in a broader context. This is not about transparency, what you're saying, what I hear. It's about relationships. So it drove me absolute bananas at our little consulting firm, where people sat in cubicles and sent people emails rather than standing up over the cubicle and saying, you know. And it became a way of avoiding work, you know, because you send an email and you say, I'm done, you know, I did my part, right? Now it's up to them, right? And the idea of actually standing up in the cubicle and saying, let's work this out, right, is much more difficult, much easier to send the email. So to me, I think you're absolutely right. To me, it's about relationships, and it's about, when I was talking about the interdependence thing, I think we are in a period of time where relationships are going to be more important than they've ever been before in getting hard work done. Right? It's not going to be dependent on authority. It's not going to be dependent on a consulting firm. It's going to depend on the strengths of relationships. We are in a... Pardon? Yes. And, but, you know, I mean, I grew up in the legislature I was in the legislature in a very formative period. And one of the things I learned there is you can say the nastiest things you can imagine to somebody and then put your arms around them 10 minutes later, because in a legislative body, that's this interdependence thing. In a legislative body, it was a profound learning experience for me, partially because I was so inexperienced in life. But in a legislative body, you can't rule anybody out if you want to accomplish anything. Because once you rule anybody out, then the percentage of people you got to get with you increases, right? And if you say, I'm not going to talk to those jerks, they're jerks, they don't agree with me in anything, you know, then all of a sudden you've narrowed the pool and you've got a much harder job. So there's a tremendous systemic pressure never to let anything become personal, even though I say to you, you are the worst legislator I've ever seen in my life, right? But it ain't personal, right? This is just what we're doing, right? And I think that's part of where I'm coming from, this, that it's really about relationships, and those relationships are going to be critical in trying to make progress on difficult issues. We talked a little bit across the room about how the connections among the 50, 75 people in this room, whatever it is now, we're all here at this biennial, but my assumption is that it wouldn't take very long for us to begin to find connections that are not so obvious between us, which in some difficult time would be incredibly important in order to move forward. So that seems absolutely right to me.
There's a question right here.
Okay.
In your discussion of it being normal to sacrifice your body and not to, and that's something that I see is very common in Jewish culture, I think the biggest thing we need to take away from that is the idea of delegation. I think we, as a community, do a very poor job of delegating authority to others and directing work to people and helping them accomplish those goals.
I think that's right. But again, what I'd be interested in is what values does non-delegating serve? Why do we? I was saying in the other room. I don't know. Were you there? You know, there is no such thing as a dysfunctional organization, because every organization is perfectly organized to get the result it is currently getting. So there's no such thing as a dysfunctional family or a dysfunctional organization, right? So the question that I would ask is, what interests are served by the reluctance to delegate? You know, and it feels to me part of it is this idea that you are doing noble work, and if you're sacrificing your body for the cause, that makes you even more noble than you were before.
Right. Your discussion about relationships actually triggered something in my mind. I not too long ago went to a talk where it was also about strengthening congregations, and the point that was made by the presenter was that for millennials in particular, they don't look at the world in the same kind of structured, hierarchical way in which, you know, a world I grew up in, and in fact are more interconnected. Yes. And will come together for tasks and bring together, but don't want to belong to committees. And so it strikes me that this is part of the change that you're talking about, and I'd like maybe you take just a couple of minutes. I know you don't have a lot of time, but maybe reflect on how what you've talked about, you know, how we deal with that issue in building.
I think it's very connected. You know, my youngest is 34 years old, right at the cusp of the millennium, and he, you know, his attitude about loyalty is completely different than mine, completely different than mine. You know, his attitude about privacy is completely different than mine, right? And you can, it's jarring when there's something that you think is really important and a high moral value, and he isn't, you know, and he's a good kid. I mean, and he doesn't relate to it at all. So that gets us back to this empathy thing. You know, if you start from the proposition not that they're wrong because they don't value loyalty like we did, but that there's something in the way they look at life that we need to understand in order to mobilize them, in order to engage them, right? That gets you to this place. But I think you're right. I think it's a very, very different set of values, you know.
I'm having an empathetic moment about getting you to your airplane.
Okay, we have one
and
last.
I think we should thank Marty Linsky.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And congratulate him on the birth of a second grandchild and wish him well.
Yeah, I'm going to go see him tonight. Okay. Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you very much. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yep.
Thank you. So what were you going to ask?
No,